Hello and welcome to the All About Symbian podcast. We are back on the insights. It is number 60 and welcoming back from MWC in Barcelona, scurringly going over his notes in the corner, so he won't say hello just yet, is Rafe Blanford. But with me after last week's tri-parade review of MWC on an evening basis, Steve Litchfield. Hi, Steve.
Hi there, I'm here.
Right then, so we've had a week past and everything is sort of the dust has settled and everything. If I was to say to you briefly, what do you think the main message out of MWC was? What would you go for?
Well, I saw Rafe being interviewed on the MIR show, and I, without wishing to preempt what Rafe is about to say, he used the word openness, and I have to say that was a bit of a theme that everyone showed how their APIs were open and their OS was open, and the people whose OS wasn't open, for example, Apple, weren't there at all. So I think that was very much a theme. For me, the absolute standout highlight of the show, despite a minor disappointment, was the Nokia N86 8MP for reasons which we may go into later on, but that was the highlight for me.
And as we hinted there, joining us back from the sun-drenched shores of the Catalonian coast, we have the man himself, the boss, Mr. Rafe Blanford. Welcome back, Rafe.
Thank you for that introduction, Ewan.
Not a problem. How much alcohol did you drink?
None at all, because I was working ever so hard.
Good man, good man. That's what you like to hear from us, and you're following by example, I think. Right, I'm going to put you on the spot now. Steve's already given us one word, which is openness. What about five words, tags, and not phrases, and not paragraphs, words here, that you think sum up MWC from your point of view, because you were actually there on the floor, as opposed to watching us remotely?
That's a very tough question, especially for me, who likes to be long-winded about things. But choosing five words quite carefully, number one, I think, would be economy. Number two would be touch. Number three would be openness. Number four would be QWERTY. And number five would be app stores.
Okay, so the great thing is now, because normally, dear listener, we actually sit down and do up our notes of what we're going to talk about in these podcasts beforehand. Here, Race just said, oh, let Ewan chair it, which is probably a mistake, and he's forgotten he's been away for a week, and we'll just wing it. In actual fact, now, Race's given us our structure, and given that Steve's already mentioned openness, Rafe, let's start on that one. Why do you think MWC was all about openness this year?
I really think that's just a general direction of the industry. But it was very noticeable compared to even a few years ago how the idea of openness, and that's expressed in several terms, has just become generally accepted. There was a keynote with OPK from Nokia, with Steve Ballmer from Microsoft, and the CEO of AT&T, who were all talking about the importance of openness for innovation in the mobile space. They all had slightly different definitions of the same thing. I mean, they used the same words but meant different things. But the idea of openness, and what I mean by that is cooperation with others, standards, platforms, and that kind of thing. And you can actually pick out different ones of those, and they're all important in different ways to different companies. Sort of in the broader context, looking at the open mobile platforms in particular, Symbian had a very good show, Windows Mobile had a good show, Android was maybe a little quieter than people were expecting, but I think there's good reasons for that. I think it takes a little while to cook devices, and Android is still a little early on its life cycle, so more on the year, but people were talking about creating stuff on top of open platforms. The debate about them was long gone, it actually has been for a while, but seeing a whole flurry of announcements on top of those kind of open platforms. So that's why I talk about openness.
I get the sense that quite a few companies are saying openness almost for the sake of openness, because one company is doing it, everybody else. I mean, is it a bandwagon thing? Is it a genuine philosophical change? Or are they, you know, just filling up a press release and going, look, we're as good as everybody else, we're not being left behind?
Yes, I think there is a certain element of that. And as you probably took from my slightly waffly answer, that's definitely true. There are companies embracing openness in different ways, and just like something like LTE, there's actually any number of ways you can define it. But I don't think that's really any change to normal. It was interesting, the keynote I referred to, Nokia is embracing openness in a way that I think is fairly unique, and they're basing their entire business model on that, and I think that's reflected in the move to the open source Symbian Foundation. but is also wider across their business as a whole, the idea of cooperating with other companies. Now, it's difficult to, you know, draw any absolute conclusions about this because Nokia is still a competitive business. So it's not sort of all holding hands and singing we're one big happy world. But I would contrast it with, say, the approach of someone like Microsoft. And it's equally valid business model, I would hasten to add, who are licensing Windows Mobile and who see openness as a way of creating choices for consumers, not necessarily an intrinsic way of doing business. I think it's, you can make too much of this, but there is definitely something there. But you are right, openness can mean any number of different things. You know, one can talk about open standards, and we think about the Bondi initiative from the OMTP, the One API, which is looking to sort of standardize operator-specific APIs, and there's a lot of that kind of thing, and that's to be encouraged, and I think everyone agrees on that sort of thing. And then there's openness in terms of how you actually conduct business and the open source side of things. And they may be less strongly endorsed, but certainly a significant movement with the likes of Android and the Symbian Foundation. So, yes, you have to be very careful when using openness because there is no clear definition. And I think that's why it's important to talk about it in more detail rather than use it as a generalizing term.
You talked a fair bit there about businesses and plans and how, you know, giving choice for the consumers and everything. And obviously, the companies out here are there to make money. That's what good businesses are meant to do. You hear me, Twitter? But the economy was looming large over this. The economic situation in the world is vastly different from what was at MWC 2008. And even to a certain extent, even different from CES at the start of the year. In this, you know, last eight weeks or so, there's been this, you know, sort of creeping, oh great, this is the sort of situation we're in. I mean, we've talked a fair bit on All About Symbian and in these inside podcasts that the economy is going to come into play in terms of contracts and phones and cost to the user and networks and the manufacturers and so on. And did you see any evidence that the world economic conditions has changed the course of any of these companies, or are they very much on such long-term planning that it's like a super tanker and they're going to have to wait before they can react?
There certainly is a lead time to these things, particularly with any announcement, news, devices, services or whatever. But the economy was looming everyone's mind. You know, nearly every press conference and every briefing I had was in the light of the economic situation, dot, dot, dot. And companies are certainly putting strategies in place. There's no question of that. How much impact it has, it's really quite difficult to judge at this stage. You know, MWC was a lot quieter in many ways this year. The stands were smaller, you know, instead of having double deckers, it was just a single deck in the, you know, Hall 8 where the big manufacturers are. But at the same time, there was perhaps less pessimism than I was expecting. I mean, people do feel that mobile technology has a role to play in sort of, as a whole in leading being one way we can get led out of the economic situation, because it's a very vibrant, cutting-edge industry. And there's certainly a lot that can be done to sort of help reduce costs and that kind of thing. And I certainly saw several services based around that kind of theme.
What was the most cheekiest service you saw for reducing a cost?
I wouldn't say it was anything was necessarily cheeky. I mean, if I had to pick out one thing, I'd actually point to the sort of proliferation of relatively cheap devices, particularly in the QWERTY segment. This does echo the E63, but I'm thinking some of the ones from Vodafone. I think it's the Vodafone 1234, and some more along the lines of the ones we've seen earlier this year from LG and Alcatel. Sort of updates on those, you know, pushing below the £100 mark. So there was definitely economy there. And, you know, there was a certain amount of discussion about how people may be moving to SIM-only deals, so i.e. people won't necessarily be replacing their handset on the subsidy model. But it's pretty difficult to draw one conclusion when we're talking about a global market where there's a great deal of variability. But everyone was expecting there to be a decline in sales, and that, you know, has a natural impact on everybody. But there was sort of maybe a discussion about how services could add value without adding significant costs. And I think that's clearly a strategy that's going to play in a lot more in the future as well. But as I say, I think perhaps it's a bit early to look at things directly out of the economic situation. Because, as I say, you know, there is a lead time to these things, and it's more a shifting in attitude in response to the economic climate that may have impacts in the years to come. rather than any direct announcements I'd point to right now. I mean, clearly everyone was cutting back, but it's, you know, we aren't seeing any companies fail yet. That will probably come in time. But MWC sort of retained some of the optimism for which I think it's sort of well known for.
Well, you mentioned there are QWERTY devices and small devices. Obviously, a number of manufacturers take this chance. Even though it's technically a B2B conference, there's a lot of media and eyes going on to launch new devices. So the big question, you've already kind of raised half of one, which is the rise of the QWERTY keyboard in the mid to low range devices. But that E55 keyboard with two letters on each key, is it actually something that works?
Yes, it is. I was very pleasantly surprised by this device. You know, I saw it announced in the press conference. I thought, yes, that 20 key thing, I've tried those in the past and it's not really for me. I had an opportunity to actually give it a decent go. And apart from the fact that, much to my horror, Rafe wasn't in the predictive dictionary, it actually works surprisingly well. And the keyboard is really marvellously engineered. I mean, it's the small details that make the difference on usability. And in that particular case, what we've got is the two centre keys, centre columns are right, slightly higher than the outer columns, and the keys sort of taper slightly front to back, which just means it's you're able to achieve a more accurate and a faster typing speed on it. And the predictive software does work very well. These sort of short type keyboards that have been popular in America, particularly on the BlackBerrys, have worked very well. I think there is something of instinctive reaction against them as being alien, but once you start trying them, they do work. So if one's willing to sort of suspend your, if you like, your reluctance to try something like that, I think it could potentially do very well. And the thing is about the E55, it has the same battery as the E71 and the E90. It's the big 1500 milliamp hour battery, which means it really will last a very, very long time on a single charge. It will almost certainly be the best performing of any smartphone we've ever seen. It's also very thin, and it has all the usual sort of Nokia services going with it, and the E-series stuff. The mail experience has been improved. It's pretty strong on the multimedia front now. It's got a audio head jack, so it's a very promising device. And if I had to pick out one device, that was one that, you know, really did impress me, although I would perhaps have some hesitation, as you suggested, that the 20 key keyboard, or the half QWERTY as Nokia referring to it as, may have just a little bit of reaction from people who aren't familiar with them. However, it is perhaps a device that might do well in the States if Nokia can get an operator to take it on. And even outside that, if people are willing to give it a go, it looks very slick as well. You know, it's a very, you know, again, Nokia have emphasized it's both a business device and something that can act as a personal device. And it has a real sense of style, which you don't usually see in enterprise devices. So, you know, yes, it was a pleasant surprise when I tried it, I think would be how I'd sum it up.
And what about the other e-device that they had at that announcement, that a press conference? They had the E75 there, didn't they? Which is, it's more than just an iterative device here, isn't it?
Yes, it is more than an iterative device. I mean, this takes Nokia and the E-series as a whole into something of a new segment, although interestingly, Nokia were talking about its history in terms of coming from the same family as the communicator with, you know, the full-size QWERTY keyboard. And what it is, it's a horizontal slider, and you get a big keyboard slide out from the side of the device. We've seen this kind of form factor from others, including the HTC Vox and a couple of other of the HTC devices. So I wouldn't say it's anything particularly new generally, but it is obviously a new direction for Nokia. And, I think it's a reflection of the fact that you can't have one device type that suits everybody. You know, people do like the E71, but if you want something smaller but retaining the half QWERTY, you get the E55. And the E75 is for those who maybe prefer the two-handed typing. It's certainly not really usable one-handed in the full keyboard mode. But I do like the fact that it's an ordinary phone when you slide it closed. I mean, again, the industrial design is excellent. You know, this is where Nokia really stood out, I think, from some of its competitors. You know, it feels very solid. Even when it's in sort of closed mode, it feels like a monocot, you know, a candy bar handset. And when you slide it out, it's equally solid. You know, the keys are well protected from being scraped. You know, the quality of the materials. It uses aluminium, interestingly, rather than stainless steel, which has been used previously in the E-series, which makes it lighter, but also means they can do more with the style. So again, we've got some more variants in the colours. The red one and the bronze one particularly stood out for me. It's just being something a bit different, having the style that I think appeals, means it'll appeal to a wider block of consumers and also enterprise users, obviously. And the in particular, that device benefits from the new messaging client. It's probably worth saying, for those that have used Nokia messaging, essentially what the new messaging client is the next version of that. So it's Nokia messaging fully integrated into the messaging application with support for HTML email, albeit the HTML support is sort of one click away. So there's still work to do there.
Yeah, can I just butt in with my own thoughts here on the E75? You and I mentioned it briefly, first of all, last week, but the actual moment when they announced the E75 surely has to class among one of the worst bloopers in the history of mobile device presentation. I'll parody it here, if I may, for people who didn't see the stream. So now I'd like to talk about E75! And basically, the poor chap presenting it got rather rattled and got confused by his model numbers. And it was all rather embarrassing. And I noticed they didn't use that clip when Nokia Conversations did their video roundup of the event. I noticed that wasn't in it. I wonder why.
No, but going back... the interesting thing is, you know, you sit through a lot of these MWC press conferences, and that was one of the lighter moments. And it is rather enjoyable when that happens sometimes, because we all make mistakes. But yes, there was certainly a certain amount of embarrassment on the stage when it happened. But I think that such things can be forgiven when you're all feeling slightly highly sprung for MWC. It really is a marathon event.
Yeah, I think, though, that if you'd been at an Apple event and some underling had made that sort of mistake, they would have been fired. But I did find it interesting that the E90 wasn't referred to. There was a strong push into the lineage of the communicators, the 9500. And to be honest, the E75 sort of pitching, it looks to be like the 9300 with that slightly smaller keyboard but normal-size-looking phone. Do you think that the oversight on not mentioning the E90 was deliberate?
I wouldn't necessarily call it deliberate, but if you remember, the 9300 also had a white version, and that's where Nokia first picked up the sort of E-series style-conscious thing with the white appealing particularly to female users and others as well. But it has had particularly high instance of female consumers being attracted to that particular styling. So I don't want to interrupt Steve, because I know he had something to add in here.
Yeah, I was intrigued by the introduction where they talked about the 9300i being one of the E75's direct ancestors, and they made this sort of marvellous quote saying, and we've taken the 9300 and we've made everything smaller, which sounds good until you realise they've made the screen smaller. And as the original screen on the 9300i was full VGA width and rather fabulous, to reduce that to a 2.4-inch quarter VGA screen is a huge, huge downer. Now, I appreciate the keyboard's probably as good, if not better, than 9300, but there is no way on God's earth that any existing communicator user, whether that's 9300, 9500, or E90, is going to switch the E75. Maybe, yes, the software's more up-to-date, but that is about it. I strongly hope and suspect there is a follow-up to the E90 in the works with a full-width screen. If Nokia haven't got that under development, then I, for one, will be very disappointed this year.
Well, let me jump back in on that one, then, because first of all, A, don't you have the N97, and the E and the N lines are starting to get very blurred. And secondly, I've just picked up the 9300 that I have here, and yeah, you are right in that sense of the size of the screen, but it's very much sort of widescreen, 2.35:1 ratio screen. What we're seeing now is a 4:3:1, and I actually feel that although it's squished, you're going to get more information and you're going to perceive more on the screen of the E75s here, Steve.
That would be true if it were a higher resolution. Say, for example, it was 4:3 or even 16:9 with a larger screen size, say 2.8 or 3.2-inch diagonal. But 2.4 inches, that's the same minuscule screen as my N82 mm-hmm. here, which is...
But remember how large the fonts were on the 9300. The fonts on the 9300, you really couldn't zoom down enough to get in the amount of information that you should theoretically get on the screen. I hate to say this, but it's not like the Cyan Agenda where you could go to an 8-pixel-sized font.
Yeah, but the E70, if you remember, was the sort of first E-series device with a really high-res screen in in terms of high resolution pixel density, and that took it to such extremes that you could hardly read the text on the screen. It was so small most of the time. So I'm sorry, I'm still looking for an E90 replacement. The N97 may cover most of the bases, but I still hope for an E-series true communicator form factor clamshell coming sometime this year, I hope.
I think you make a good point about the N97, and I certainly think that will be attractive to a certain number of the audience, but perhaps not surprisingly, I asked this question, and I got the standard Nokia response back, which Nokia continues to seek to expand its product portfolio. So basically, I watch this space. So I wouldn't be terribly surprised if we see something that form factor. I wouldn't necessarily be wanting to pin down a timing for that, because there are some issues with screen resolution, and one of the big problems with the E90 was it was a non-standard S60 screen resolution with all of that implied. So it may be that we have to wait until S60 fifth edition is sort of perhaps more mature and maybe moves on to non-touchscreen devices, but that remains to be seen. I mean, I also asked the question about the QVGA. Now, I've always said that I actually think the sort of debate about resolution is generally overplayed, and I think you only need to look at a device like the E71 to realise that QVGA can be sufficient for an awful lot of tasks, and inherent in any mobile device is the compromise of design between things like the keyboard, the size of the device, the size of the screen, the resolution. Now, in this particular case, I would actually like to see higher resolution E-series devices, because I think it would benefit from it. But I would also make the point that I'm not sure it's important, as some people might underline. And this is partly because the software has been tweaked so you do see more on the screen. And actually, I personally feel that in the case of the E75, having the sort of T9 keypad is probably more important than having, you know, a full-width screen plus the slide-out keyboard. And the reason I think that is because a lot of the time these devices are still voice-centric, and that's still a predominant means of communication for these E-series devices. And I suspect if you look at the index of the device, it's in the E7 series, there is definitely space for maybe an E8 or another E9 series device, which would perhaps become sort of the ultimate thing. But I do think it's true that there will attract a certain number of people who might have gone for the 9300 but wouldn't have gone for the 9500 will like the E75. So I think it's a case of watch this space.
Ah, how very diplomatic. right, QWERTY was one design choice. The other design choice is touch or not to touch. I'm not quite sure if there's such a thing as bad to touch, but resistive screens. You know, people always go, oh, we need capacitive now. But resistive is cheaper, and many devices, including those E1s, don't even have touch at all. Is there any sort of consensus coming out of the mobiles, Rafe, in sense of, you know, they're only for high-end devices, only for low-end devices? Where's touch? And let's look outside of just Nokia here. Let's look at the whole realm of touch devices. Where is it going?
Yes, we very much have to look outside Nokia, because a lot of the touch debate is happening outside of that, particularly with companies like Samsung. I mean, Samsung made great play of 2009, was their touch was their theme, and they announced three touch devices: the Omnia HD, which I guess we'll come back to later, the DJ, and the sort of I think it was the Ultra Touch, and there are plenty of other touch devices around. You know, there was also the HTC Magic, which is a second Android device, and there were some pushing a little bit down to the lower end of the market, but not that much. I mean, Nokia is still with the 5800 probably the best position there. But there was a lot of discussion about how important touch would be. And some people, you know, think it's the future and going to be a very dominant input mechanism. I'm not so sure, and I suspect the majority of people are probably still with me in that it's clearly going to be important, but it will tend to be towards the high end of the market and on certain types of devices. But it was very much more a stronger presence here than it has been in the past. You know, we have had the the Sony Ericsson touch phones with UIQ in the past. So it was a slight feeling of deja vu in a sense. You know, I can remember back when the W950 was launched, I think, at an MWC event. And, you know, the M600 at that same MWC, I believe. And we're seeing touch come back again. There are sort of new technologies around capacitive. You know, that's something that's on the Omnia HD, for example. But there are also demos that were showing off how resistors could be made multi-touch effectively through software and made more accurate, and that was very impressive. And capacitively is cheaper, so will be with us for some time to come. And you know, conductive things have their disadvantages, particularly for handwriting recognition, for example, which is important in some markets, or for precise selection. So trying to answer your question, yes, touch is definitely here to stay, but no, I don't really see it becoming a predominant sort of user interface paradigm. I think it's going to be important at the high end of the market, but I'm still thinking that it's going to be limited to, say, the top 10 to 20%. That's probably as accurate as I can be. But we were seeing sort of innovations on top of touch in terms of applications, and that's it's very much, you know, the result of the Apple iPhone. You know, you cannot take that away from Apple. They've certainly shifted the market, and it's been sort of the validation for touch has been the iPhone devices. Other people have been pushing it for a long time, but the iPhone showed that there could be mass market success and did a certain amount of innovation also in introducing concepts that weren't necessarily new, but to the mass market. I mean, we had multi-touch was around before. So in that sense, we can see touch has certainly come of age and is going to be an important part of the discourse in mobile for a long time to come.
Yeah, I have to just to ask you one question, Rafe. You mentioned just briefly in passing, you saw a demo of resistive touch screens being used for multitouch. Now, I can kind of guess and imagine how that might work, but if you readers of the site may notice that I've criticized the Nokia 5800 in the past because typing speed on its virtual keyboard is limited by the fact that you have to release the resistive screen in one point or with one finger before you can press down another virtual key with another finger. Now, I'm guessing the demo you saw would have a huge application in terms of speeding up typing on virtual keyboards.
Yes, definitely, Steve. This was a sort of early demo, and I'm not sure how quickly we'll see this sort of thing come onto the market. But that's the kind of innovation I expect to see in touch in the years to come, you know, improving on the basic ingredients. And a good example of this is something that I was shown by Paragon, which is the sort of parent company of Epochware, which was handwriting recognition running on a 65th edition. But what was interesting about this, it wasn't constrained to a sort of a little dialogue box as it is in the standard version. It was, you know, you could draw anywhere on the screen and you could use either the stylus or your finger, and the finger worked surprisingly well. And I'm not necessarily thinking this is for doing long emails or something like this, but it did allow you, for example, to put in a couple of letters to the input field of contacts to let you find a contact more easily. We should see this bit of software come out in spring, and it's certainly one of my ones to watch for the future. But it's kind of an innovation on touch through software that makes the whole user experience very much easier. And in this particular case, it's with resistive screen technology. And that kind of software-mediated evolution, I think, will have more of an impact on touch than any sort of innovation within the hardware.
And the Samsung devices, especially the Omnia, but obviously also the Ultra Touch as well, featuring touch heavily, but also making quite a nice splash in terms of the specifications and also the styling of the devices that they had there. We always joke that phones are just little grey boxes, but Samsung have really been able to make their new devices they had on show in Barcelona actually look very modern.
Yes, I mean, Samsung did a very good job on presenting their three sort of core devices. I spent most time with the Omnia HD for obvious reasons, but the Beat DJ, for example, allowed you to sort of be a DJ by scratching on-screen records to sort of do music mixing. I feel that sort of thing's a bit of a gimmick, but it does sort of point at what might be achievable and some of the different experiences you can achieve. And the Touch Ultra was kind of their touch with UI taken to its zenith. And really, it's quite an impressive device. The Omnia HD, you know, you have to be careful not to use too many superlatives, because ultimately this is a very impressive device.
It's a phone.
But, you know, HD recording and playback, well, playback, so what? You know, the screen, you know, doesn't necessarily support it. But when you put it onto an external TV, it really is amazing to see that that's come from a small device. I mean, we think back, you know, it's only, what, 7 years back to the 7650, where there wasn't even a video application on the device itself. And now we're recording back in HD video. And I mean, the thing that actually stood out for me most about the Omnia HD was its screen. It really is gorgeous. It's an AMOLED screen, which is, I think, the first we've seen in a mainstream touch device, and easily outshone any other screen I've seen on a mobile device. You know, it was better than Apple's achieved on the iPhone devices. It even started to put the N85 into the shade simply because it was that much bigger. And when you see it in action, I mean, the pictures really don't do it justice. I have got some video, which I hope to get up on the site later, and we're going to be doing an in-depth preview in due course. But what also impressed me about the HD is Samsung has gone to a lot of effort to sort of customize a 65th edition. And what they've done is, they, for example, on the home screen, they're using their TouchWiz UI with widgets, which are draggable off toolbars. It's difficult to explain in a podcast, but have a look at some of the pictures. And it goes further than that. You know, they put on their own applications. Again, they put together a very attractive third-party application bundle. They've changed the task switcher. So rather than just being a little pop-up, it sort of comes up as a carousel, which you can then scroll around, and there's an option to view it in what I can only really describe as an expose-like way, which people familiar with the Macs will know about. And there's an awful lot of effort gone into the device, far more, I feel, than they put into something like the i8 510, which again was technically very impressive, but perhaps didn't have the software polish. And it's significant that Samsung have used the Omnia name in here, because Omnia has been one of their most successful touch devices and is a well-known brand. And the switch from Windows Mobile to a 65th edition surprised some, although if you've been watching the tea leaves carefully, it wasn't that big a surprise. But it is a tremendous validation for a 65th edition, and does underline how serious Samsung are about this device, because it's one of their core brands in the high end of the market. And Omnia HD, I think, will be pushed far more heavily than any of the previous Samsung S60 devices. And it puts the N97 under quite intense pressure, I feel, because Samsung have really pulled all the stops out. This is the best specified phone on the market, no doubt about that. But the software does go some way to matching it. There are still problems, which I guess we'll talk about in a future podcast. But this is a really competitive device that I would have thought Nokia will be taking a very close look at this, because this is going to steal some of the market of the N97 and indeed other touch devices that Nokia may be planning, because it really blew me away. I mean, it's easy to, as I say, to talk in superlatives and want to wait till I can actually try one out for a week and give it a good going over. But I suspect this is going to be a handset that's, each year we have one that kind of stands out, or in certainly 6 months a year. And the Omnia, I think, is the one that got talked about most at the show and will be talked about most afterwards. And is certainly the one to watch this year.
Okay, thanks, Ray. We're a tiny bit short on time, but I'd like to get one last question talking in about the Ovi App Store and the Ovi, well, content store, I guess. I was intrigued by the talk about how it was an intelligent store, and that rather than being flat like Apple's iPhone store and that every application is equal before users, that things would actually get pushed to you and recommended to you in an intelligent, location-based and friend-based way. What was your take on the App Store?
I think it's possibly one of the most significant announcements of MWC. There are a lot of caveats that you have to apply to that, mainly in the implementational details, but this is going to last longer than any one device. And when you're talking about a platform that can potentially reach 300 million users by 2012, this is something that will have an impact for some time to come. My most immediate reaction was, it's good that Nokia have done this, and really they should have been doing it 6 months ago. But there was also a sense that they've been very intelligent in that actually this is not just an app store and it's not just a content store. This is the next generation because of the social location features built in. And it's probably worth explaining those just in a little bit of detail. You know, there's really two elements to it. There's the social side of it, which basically is a list of your contacts and your friends as sort of defined through Ovi contacts or a couple of other methodologies. And that will look at what your friends are buying and downloading, what they like and what they don't like, and then make recommendations based to you on that. And depending on whether you take them up or not, over time it will, you know, build up a sort of profile of whether you listen to one particular friend or not. And if you listen to one friend more than another, it will promote their suggestions over and above the others. Now, that's all automatic. There's also manual sharing, in that someone can share specifically to choose one application or piece of content with you. The other side of it is location, which starts getting even more intriguing. And this is the thing I think may take a little longer to come to full fruition. And it's not just the idea that, you know, you fly into Barcelona airport and it starts recommending you a travel guide or a map or, you know, whatever it happens to be. It will also differentiate where you are at a particular time. So it may know that you're in the office or in the home and more likely to download certain things there and therefore recommend things based on your current location. I mean, the example that was given was that when you're at home, it will recommend more entertainment options. When you're at the office, it will do more productivity stuff. I mean, it may be that for most people in the office, it's, you know, you're doing it when you're bored and so it'll start recommending entertainment stuff. But that element of it, I'm not sure we're fully grasped until we can actually have a go, and I suspect the initial version may not be all sort of, you know, fluffy bunnies bouncing through the green meadows. I think it's a very tricky thing to implement, and there are some other implementation issues I have concerns about. But it is a very powerful idea and really underlines that social location is going to be at the core of many of Nokia's services and others, I think, in the years ahead. And if you get that right, it's going to be a key differentiator and a key advantage, which I don't think it's really possible to underestimate.
There's one huge positive, which I'd like to just put in before we close the show. I mentioned on one of the previous podcasts last week that no one really knew at that stage exactly how Nokia were going to implement this Obby store in terms of getting it to users. And I said fervently, I hope they use the existing download icon that's on every single Nokia S60 phone's home screen already, so that's hundreds of millions of devices. And from what I've heard, maybe you can confirm this, but from what I've heard, they're going to do exactly that. If people, once this goes live, if people then click on download, one of the very first things they'll see is click here to download the Obby Store client, and presumably in the same way that things like Nokia Maps install themselves into the OS, the Obby Store would then be the part of the OS instead of download, so it would be like an automatic replacement, and this will happen potentially for over 100 million phones. Is that how you understand it?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Download actually has a mechanism by which it can update itself over the air, so the download application will effectively remove itself and replace it with the Obby Store. There's actually three versions of the Obby Store. There's a sort of plain XHTML version, which is fairly universally usable. There's a Java version, and there's a web runtime widget version. So download will probably replace itself with the web runtime version, and this is how the Obby Store can be on tens of million devices within the first year. And yes, it's a very powerful mechanism, and that's one of the implementational details I do believe they've got absolutely right. Just to sort of, you know, on the other side of the coin, some of the areas where I still have concern are, you know, you do have to put your application in as a full version of the SIS file, if you like. There is no DRM currently built into the store unless you use some of the OMA stuff. So if you have if a developer has a custom sort of setup whereby, you know, it generates registration codes, that won't work. They'll have to do a sort of a full version. There aren't any trials, for example, at the moment, which is a bit of a concern for me. Because I think there may be some initial developer reluctance to go down that model. We've seen the problems that creates with software piracy. Also, because it's not the only channel in the market, there isn't going to be quite the same impetus for developers to sign up for the Obby Store. I think in time it will become an absolutely necessary thing to do, but some may wait to see how it goes down. So there's that kind of concern for me. There's also some issues around how difficult it is going to be get freeware into the store because of the necessity of having it Symbian signed and being a company. I think that's important because we've seen how successful in the App Store and the Android Store, so the Android marketplace, freeware has been as a driver. Nokia need to do that as well. And just as a kind of a last point, I think a lot of people are missed, is you can actually get things like wallpaper and ringtones. So actually that's going to be more important on Series 40 devices. So if you're a little cynical, you can say that's where I think a lot of the initial success may come from. But it is important that Nokia get it right the first time, because just as with download, people will look at it once, and if it doesn't work, they may then not go back to it. However, I am encouraged by the fact that a lot of the Nokia people who I spoke to are behind the store have exactly the right attitude, realise these problems exist, and there's very much already thought being put onto what happens next. And indeed, we're not actually seeing the first version of this of the store, it's actually going to be version 1.5 that gets the initial release, and they've been doing a lot of testing internally. So I'm reasonably optimistic, and I do think, I mean, as I said, this was the most significant announcement, and it's going to be incredibly interesting to watch because this is going to shape the future. And at the end of the day, Nokia is the biggest manufacturer, and their content store will be the most important, because if you're a content developer, be it applications, you know, wallpaper, video, whatever it happens to be, this will be a way to address anything up to 40% of the mobile market. And mobile is the dominant way of accessing this kind of content, or will be in the future. You know, we talk a lot about the scale of mobile, but when you're talking about something that will be the predominant consumer electronics device on the planet, indeed already is, this is why the content store is so significant, because it will be the way a lot of people could potentially consume content in the future. The operators, they'll certainly have something to say, but T-Mobile's already signed up for this. I think we could talk about this a lot more, and we'll save it for another podcast, so I'll finish it there.
Indeed, yes, Mobile World Congress, of course, ran for 3 days. Steve and I managed to keep talking for 3 days on it, and now we have Rafe at, so your answers on an email or the back of a postcard or a stuck down envelope to us, and they get a prize for the person who can guess the longest. I do love the fact that the content store and Ovi raises the intriguing possibility that we could actually charge for this podcast. And I'm just now trying to work out whether we'd make more money selling the full length version or an edited version in which we get everything down to about 15 minutes every episode.
What are you suggesting, Ewan?
I have absolutely no idea. Again, answers on a postcard or a stock down envelope. But seriously, though, MWC is a huge undertaking to cover, to report, to look back on. We've really kind of stuck to the sort of manufacturers in this insight. But as you heard there from Rafe, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of third parties, a lot of developers. There's a lot of the smaller guys as well. We're going to really dig into that into the next episode of The Insight, which will be Insight number 61, and get into the what's it like on the floor and on the ground, as it were, in the nitty-gritty, the hustle and the bustle and all the bodies pushing you around trying to find something on a stand. That will be in our next Insight, which will be number 61, which will be due out next week. But for now, it's probably over his jet lag, but still trying to recover some lost fluids through Lucas Aid. It's a thank you to Rafe Blanford.
Thanks, Ewan.
And Steve, as always, it's a pleasure to not talk to you in one of these podcasts.
We didn't have any problems limiting ourselves to half an hour last week, did we, Ewan?
I think I've already put the boot in. If you'd like to put the boot in again, that shouldn't be a problem.
No. We love hearing Rafe's in-depth analysis. It's just that we're going to bump the rest of it to part two. So goodbye from me.
Yeah, and thank you all out there for listening. We know many of you would have missed these last week because you were in Barcelona yourself. So we'll make sure we carry on the in-depth insights as we go on. It's www.allaboutsymbian.com. My name's Ewan Spence. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll call that a wrap.